Well, thank you. Thank you for that session. We go straight into the next session, and then, although we go straight into the next session, and we'll have a little break at the end of this session, since according to the program, it's 3 solid hours. I think we better have a little relaxation at some point. Anyhow, that takes us now to our second session this afternoon. Will constitutional theocracy bloom after the Arab Spring? We have the paper by Clark Lombardi, and our discussant is William Quant.
I wasn't quite sure if I was going to comment on Clark's presentation, or present his paper, although he's sitting right here and could presumably present it even more credibly. But I gather this is your peculiar law school way of doing things, and I'm happy to join your subculture for an hour or so. So what I'm going to try to do is give you an idea of what Clark's paper says. He can then correct all the mistakes I make. And I'll make a few comments about the key concepts that he's dealing with. Basically, this is a very interesting paper about a book by Ron Herschel called Constitutional Theocracies, which I have not read, so I can't comment on the book, but I can tell you what Clark says about the book, and I trust that his description of it is a comprehensive one. The paper basically is a presentation of the key idea of constitutional theocracy and a critique of it. I think Clark finds the core concept flawed in certain ways, and I'll try to draw your attention to that. I must say I share his concern that the term constitutional theocracy is not terribly helpful and somewhat misleading. I gather, however, that this is part of a project that looks at not just the Middle East, where I find some problems with the concept, but is trying to look at the world, a modest goal of how religion is kind of rising everywhere and confronting political orders that are more secular and liberal. And the book seems to say that the outcome of this is a kind of confrontation that reaches a kind of compromise between principles from the constitutional order and demands from the growing and assertive religious forces. Just to give you a sense of how Clark describes this, I'm going to sort of summarize using his description on page 9 of Herschel's book. It says, the book envisions a world in which religious values are almost always in regular and direct conflict with liberal political principles and with principles of a market economy. Those who want the state's laws to respect religion have been growing in power and thus have been able to demand that the state carve out some role for religious law. Elites, however, have insisted, I'm not sure who the elites are, but they're political elites, I guess, have insisted that the impact of religious law be limited by an insistence that religious law never violate basic principles of liberal constitutionalism. So here's the kind of tension between people defending the constitutional order, but acknowledging that religious demands are growing. The clash between these groups results in the creation of a legal system that contains a number of elements that include giving a significant role to the injunctions of the state's established religion. Not only does religious law apply directly in some cases, but all law is required to be consistent with the injunctions of the established religion. The constitutional court is tasked with the job of reconciling the Constitution's non-religious provisions with its religious ones, ensuring that the religious provisions are never interpreted and applied in a way that permits the application of law that is inconsistent with democratic constitutionalist principles. So basically saying that the upper hand remains with the more secular liberal forces who have a chance to sort of veto those aspects of religious law which challenge those principles. Again, we need to ask Clark to expand on that perhaps a little bit. Put differently, in a constitutional theocracy, the relationship of religious regulatory authority to constitutionalist values is analogous to the relationship of majoritarian political power to constitutional values in a liberal democracy. In other words, the Constitution may defend minority rights even when a democratic majority may try to overcome those. So that's the kind of, I think that's the analogy you're making. Regulation of social life is controlled to a large extent by religious authorities. I don't think Karima is going to like that. Who establish much of day-to-day regulation and establish principles that no law can contravene. Their ability to exercise power, however, is constrained by a judicially enforceable requirement that the law of the state never violate liberal constitutional values. So basically, we're seeing a description of a hybrid system, constitutional theocracy, that tries to balance the tensions between growing demands from religious conservatives who want religious law to apply to more of life, and the constitutional order that tries to protect certain principles and liberal values and so forth. Clark's critique, basically, of the book's main theme that I've just described is he says that Herschel does not properly understand the term Islamic law, that he treats it as a one-dimensional phenomena, and although Clark says that there may have been a time when that was a fairly accurate description of Islamic law, that in the contemporary period in the Sunni world in particular, there have been, quote, revolutionary changes that have created a much more diverse body of discourse among Muslim legal scholars, and that now you do not necessarily see this polarity between something called Islamic law that is always necessarily in conflict with liberal political or economic values. There are now among Islamists those who accept certain liberal principles, and that this gives you a little bit more fluidity in this confrontation than Herschel acknowledges. So he goes on to say that there are many conflicting interpretations of what Islamic law means, and that most Islamic scholars would now accept that the role of the state is to adjudicate among those. In other words, the state ultimately has the upper hand by referring to the principle of what serves the common good, the principle of maslaha. And that with that in hand, the state can, in a sense, be the arbitrator among the different interpretations of Islamic law. Modern Islamists, Clark writes, want the state to develop a body of law that is consistent with a few clear scriptural rules. Unfortunately, some of those, again, may not be rules that are compatible with a human rights agenda or a feminist agenda, and to make it compatible with the ideas of public welfare and justice. Clark prefers to use the term Islamic constitutionalism rather than constitutional theocracy, which he borrows from Nathan Brown, among others, and I think by and large that's a more useful term, partly because I think if you take literally what theocracy is meant, it means quite in its foundation, it means the rule of God, and we're really not talking about God giving orders to anybody. This hasn't happened for a while, according to most people. But it's about people struggling for power using different repertoires, and one repertoire is religion. So I think leave God out of it for now. These are not debates that are being resolved by divine intervention, which is sort of the implication when we talk about theocracy. And in all honesty, theocracy has a fairly pejorative notion. We mostly don't believe that it's a viable notion in the contemporary world to have political leaders claiming their legitimacy comes directly from God, who speaks through them, which would be a kind of pure theocratic state. Instead, we have things like malocracies or ulamocracies or just plain old autocracies that claim to be based on religion. So Clark comes to politics, which, since I'm a political scientist, I'm glad he gets there. And he says that in order to protect rights in the post-Arab Spring, in these periods of constitution-making, it's going to take more than just the legal scholars arguing. It's going to really require a political pact that ensures that absolute power will not be monopolized by anyone. So he talks about a need for a kind of Madisonian checks and balances, and that there will be guarantees for certain fundamental rights, which are political conditions that need to be looked at and are not derived directly from any particular interpretation of Sharia. I would maybe just conclude with a couple of observations of my own. I just got back from Egypt last week, and I heard a very interesting presentation from the grandson of the second Supreme Guide of the Muslim Brethren, very secular-sounding guy, quite surprisingly. He's doing his MA at American University in Cairo. Because of his name, he has enormous religious credibility, but he talks, for all I could tell, like a political scientist. And he was dissecting the different varieties of political Islam in Egypt today. It was really quite interesting, because he didn't just say there are Salafis and Ikhwan. He basically said there are about five or six different tendencies that are quite intensely competing with one another. And I think Nathan might be able to add to that. And he said, they will all say that they want to see Sharia applied, but if you ask them what they mean by that, they have very radically different meanings. The Salafis are quite literal about one school of law trumps all the others and should be applied, but they are politically naive and have very little notion of how to make that happen. Others have thought a lot about it and are much more tolerant and pluralistic. So in the Egyptian case, there seems to be actually quite a bit of diversity between relatively liberal, open-minded interpretations of what the role of religion in society might be, and some very, very fundamentalist ones that probably do cause a lot of concern quite legitimately. Nowhere, however, do I think we see in the Arab Spring, as I see it playing out, Islamists emerging as a unified bloc, determined or able to impose a narrow orthodoxy on society, although I know people worry that that could happen. As I said, in Egypt there seem to be a number of tendencies, and in the Egyptian parliament, the Ikhwan and the Salafis get along so poorly that they actually sit on different sides of the hall, and in between them are the seculars. I asked my secular friend, who is a member of the parliament, how do you get along with these guys? He said, well, the Muslim Brethren are old professional pals, and you can bargain with them and make deals, and they're perfectly used to the game of politics and deal-making, so I think with them we're not going to have too much trouble. I said, what about the Salafis? He said, the Salafis said they're actually kind of nice people, but this is rather patronizing sounding, but I'm just going to tell you what he said. He said, they're very naive about politics. They have been out of politics for most of the past 30 years. They were tolerated by the Mubarak regime. In fact, they were encouraged by the Mubarak regime because they were the counterweight to the Ikhwan. Whenever the Mukhabarat would sweep up Islamists in Egypt, if they caught a Salafi, they would let them go. And these are people who have a very simple agenda. It consists of establishing certain basic principles. They tend to be in the rural areas. They are totally new to politics. And he says, I don't worry about them very much now because they don't know how to get anything done. But they are quite different from the Muslim Brethren. So that's probably worth our remembering. The other thing that struck me as interesting on this trip was that 6 months ago when I was in Egypt, people were genuinely wondering, what's it going to be like if the Islamists do as well as they might? Well, they've done even better. And most of my relatively secular friends weren't all that worried about it. What they were really worried about was the SCAF, the Supreme Command of the Armed Forces. All the graffiti around Tahrir Square now is anti-SCAF. It's not anti-Ikhwan, it's not anti-Salafi, it's anti-SCAF. Because what they're fearful of is that the revolution really didn't get anywhere. We got rid of Mubarak and we've got the SCAF and they're not going to go away. And in a sense, not much has changed at all. So is that the Egypt that will bring human rights and feminist rights and pluralism? No, they're worried that the old order is going to simply be perpetuated. And I found much less anxiety about a new order that will emerge from a competition of basically what I think are three or four quite significant groups, all of whom will have a voice in the new Egypt. One will definitely be the different varieties of political Islam. They won the election. It was a relatively fair election. And I think you have to acknowledge that that means they have a voice in the new order. The liberals did not do well. The liberal, secular, whatever you want to call them, they were divided. They didn't get their act together. They didn't get out to the countryside to court votes. They thought they deserved to win because they'd made the revolution. And I think their moment of truth is now coming. How do we take the continuing revolutionary legitimacy that they enjoy and turn it into organizational power? There's a certain naivete about the revolutionaries thinking that, you know, the kind of horizontal structures are great. They get people out in the streets. You can mobilize very quickly. But they also need leadership, and they do need organization, and they do need to get out the vote the next time they have a chance. They did really very poorly when it came to getting out the vote. And then there still is the massive bureaucracy, which hasn't changed one iota. You look around, if you know anybody in any position of authority, they're almost all still there. This was not like the Iranian Revolution, which basically purged the top elite and forced them into exile. Most of the Fuluo, the remnants of the old regime, are quite frankly still there. And that's going to be a weight that doesn't change overnight, including the judiciary. The judiciary under, and Clark knows this far better than I, under Mubarak had a degree of independence. Every now and then they would say no and it would stick. They still are that way. And you ask, why are there all these kind of odd moments in this period when there is a court case going ahead against NGOs who are promoting human rights and things like that? Part of it is a judge who simply says, you cannot tell me to call off this case. Even though the top generals want him to, because the independence of the judiciary to a certain degree is still there. And then finally, even though the SCAF, the Supreme Command of the Armed Forces, does seem to want to get more into the background, they don't like this exposed position of where everybody hates them. Not everybody hates them. There are a lot of Egyptians who crave order and stability and all the normal things that people crave. And see the generals as contributing to that. But there are an awful lot who are worried that they're actually doing just the opposite, that they're contributing to the breakdown of law and order, and somewhat deliberately so, to justify their continuing role. They will continue to have some kind of a role. These are not people who will go gently into the night and say, we've served our country and we're going into graceful retirement. They own about a quarter of the Egyptian economy by most accounts. They have very, very strong vested interests in the current order. They are extremely wealthy, and they love giving orders. They're not great at consulting. So I think we're going to see a very complicated reconfiguration of power in Egypt. One portion of that will be the writing of a constitution, but that's actually going to come rather late in the day after the power configuration has sorted itself out.
Well, thank you very much for that. That's been a tremendously helpful set of insights into what's going on in Egypt. But anyhow, Clark, it's now your turn to come back and make whatever comment you want about the comments.
And about your paper.
Well, thank you very much. And I did want to thank the organizers, Dennis and Mila, for inviting me to this. I always find this format extremely extremely helpful, and I've learned a lot from the papers I've heard. So knowing how useful these things can be, I did send in a paper that is very much a work in progress, and so I appreciate everyone engaging with it, and I do look forward to the comments, because it's something that has been it deals with an issue that I've been wanting to address for a while, and address in the nuance and complexity that it deserves. Let me quickly say that I think Professor Quant summarized my basic argument and my summary of Herschel's argument extremely well. Ron Herschel described a series of textual phenomena. He described two things that he sees, two patterns he sees in global constitutionalism around the world. The first is a series of textual provisions that appear in, he says, in constitutions around the world, although in fact they only appear in Muslim constitutions. But he implies that they might creep up in other places as well. But it is, in theory, a globalizing, a book that makes a global theory about how religion is being related to the state around the world. But it is, in fact, in practice, if you look at it, a book about constitutionalism in the Muslim world. So it's of particular interest to me because I've been looking at those constitutions for a while. He makes two claims. He identifies a series of textual provisions that exist in them, and they're exactly the ones that that Bill described. He also describes a phenomenon in which constitutional courts interpret them in the most liberal possible way. So they interpret these provisions as permitting constitutional courts the power to check religiosity in society. This struck, and then he argues that he makes an explanation for both why this pattern appeared. Why do we see these textual provisions, and why do we see courts interpret them the way they do? And then he talks about the ramifications of the rise of constitutional theocracy. So it's an extremely ambitious book, and it should be admired for that. At the same time, it strikes me that if you do understand the history of the recent history of Islamic legal theory and of Islamic constitutionalism and of Islamic politics, then the explanation for why this pattern has occurred is incomplete. Some of the reasons that he identifies are very important aspects of the rise of this pattern, but it's sufficiently incomplete that it's misleading as to why they appear in so many places, and more importantly, it doesn't explain why they're going to continue to exist after the revolutions of the Arab Spring. And so I wanted to flesh out the explanation for why these patterns have occurred, and then say that if you understand why they're so attractive to Muslim polities, then we'll understand why they're going to survive into a period in which the power structures have entirely changed in the way that Professor Quant described. So that was my ambitious attempt to talk about an ambitious paper. I would only say this because I think most of my arguments were very well summarized by Bill, and I thank you for that. The explanation for why these constitutional provisions have occurred is incomplete for the following reason. It assumes that the only people who had a say in these constitutions being drafted the way they are and being interpreted the way they are secularists. The whole story assumes that religion is always conservative and constitutional courts are always secular, and therefore that the constitutional theocracy is a theocracy bad conservative checked by a secular institution, thus constitutionalist and fundamentally liberal. And he even adds to it market friendly. He actually does assert in his book that religious people are by definition opposed to the market, which I think he may finally have taken this into the realm of the entirely implausible as opposed to merely wrong. But in that story, it's a little bit hard to understand why in the Muslim world this type of concession would have bought legitimacy for a government. If, in fact, everybody knows and can see that these provisions are a way in which liberal secular institutions can check religious institutions, then this would not be a particularly effective way for governments to create constitutional reforms that would build up their prestige in the minds of the public. Nor would it explain the fact that most of the elements of the constitutional theocracy are ones that Islamist parties that have appeared have insisted they're going to keep in exactly the form that Herschel describes. So this cannot really be only something that is attractive to liberals as a way to checking religious people. These provisions were attractive to the religious majority, and he doesn't explain why. So part of the story that I wanted to explain is that Islamic law itself is so highly contested that it has developed a theory that the state has a role in interpreting Islamic law. This is in the Sunni world. We'll hear about the Shia world later, although I think it's coming to seem, there seems to be a convergence theory, if I understand Professor Kunkler's paper. With that in mind, the role of judges in interpreting Islamic law is not only to secularize, as he puts it, Islamic law. It is quite literally to play an essential role in the Islamic State. In the mind of Islamists, the state needs to have institutions interpreting Islamic law, or else we don't have a viable ongoing interpretation of Islamic law. And if you look at what the Ikhwan are saying, and even some of the Salafis are saying, there is a high tolerance for state interpretation of Islamic law being binding upon the people. So that these constitutional provisions are not only a way to create a sham Islamization in the world, but they really are playing an essential and important role in Islamic political theory and Islamic legal theory. And this is why the Muslim Brotherhood and others are going to continue to have a constitutional Islamization provision in which courts are going to interpret Islamic law, because otherwise Islamic law can't be put into a meaningful form by which the state can be governed. And that's an extremely important aspect of this story. The second element of this, it struck me, is that once you realize that this has happened, then some of the conceptual categories that he uses to define a constitutional theocracy simply don't make sense. They simply don't exist. So that to describe the difference between a religious tribunal and a court, given the state of contemporary Sunni legal theory and political theory, and the things that Islamists are actually saying, does not make any sense, because a court can be a religious institution. It plays an essential role in interpreting and applying Islamic law for the state. So it plays a role in the construction of religious identity. And at the same time, many of the things that he identifies as religious tribunals are tribunals of people who are appointed by the state as the official interpreter of Islamic law in the area of family law or in other areas. So I wanted to point out that both, if we understand this breakdown of consensus in the Sunni world about what Islamic law means and understand the role that Islamist thinkers have given to the state in managing that breakdown of consensus, then we understand both that Herschel's explanation for why these provisions exist is incomplete and the ramifications of it existing are incomplete. But it does lead to a point that, although I think many of the things I've written over the past 10 years will fit entirely into the category that Karima calls rubbish, of saying that we should engage with moderate Islamists and it plays a role. I've written articles that suggest that this can be productive. At the same time, I do understand in a very deep way, I think, her argument, and I think there's something she says that is correct and needs to be pointed out. Another reason Islamists like these provisions is that they're not inevitably liberal. That there is no, who controls the constitutional court in Egypt will control the interpretation of Islamic law. And that will be, in the minds of Islamist thought, the morally binding as well as legally binding interpretation of Islamic law in the state. And so her insistence that we look at the political realities and understand who's going to be in charge. I would disagree conceptually, perhaps, with some of the way she defines religion or secularism, but the practical impact is a very serious one, is that we need to understand that this framework of constitutional theocracy that Herschel believes was put in place to create a check on religious impulses has no essential ability to do so, even in the way that Herschel describes it. And therefore, that what we're really seeing is an ongoing debate about religious constitutionalism. How can a society in which religious groups are the majority political institutions, how can that society conceptualize constitutionalist thought, including feminist thought and liberal thought, within them? And to do that, it strikes me that we should stop paying so much attention to whether or not the Constitution has those five elements. It strikes me that the five elements he's talking about don't tell us at all whether the state is going to be liberal or illiberal or what's going to happen. Rather, what's going to tell us whether the state is liberal or illiberal is going to be the construction of political mechanisms, among other things, that permit religious discourse and disputation so that the liberal voices that exist, the liberal interpretations of Islam, are going to be able to continue to survive. Because the countries in which religification of politics has become most pernicious are the ones in which the state begins to control control religious discourse, and thus the boundaries of legitimacy. And I think in Professor Kunkler's paper, we'll see intimations that perhaps that's exactly what's happening, and perhaps what's most scary about what's happening in Iran. Thank you. I think I went over my time. But I look forward to your comment.
Thank you very much, Clark. I think you're just about right on time. So we're We now are open for discussion. Do we have any questions, any observations around the table to begin with? Perhaps I could just, while we're waiting for people to collect their thoughts, Clark, perhaps I could just direct a point to you. Really, that last one, I just didn't quite grasp the distinction you were making between, on the one hand, the political process where meanings of Islam will be worked out, as I understood it, and on the other hand, you're saying that the courts are necessary to interpret Islam. I don't quite understand. Isn't there some tension between those two very ideas?
Well, one might think so if we look at the history of the Christian West as understanding what constitutes religious authority or not. Although some people have referred to what's happened in the modern Muslim world as the Protestantization of Islam. I think that's problematic for all sorts of reasons. But there is an element of truth in it to this extent. There ceases to be an identifiable group of people who are religious authorities, who are recognized uniformly as religious authorities. And therefore, to talk about religious authority being located outside the state and thus being a check on the state has ceased to be a meaningful category. And so instead, the state identifies certain people who are counted as religious authorities. One of the things that I've been really interested in is in 19th century American constitutional theory, the regular citation to the Bible in constitutional court cases, mostly in state courts. You see this regularly, and occasionally you see it in the Supreme Court. Some of the most sort of famous court cases have these things that always get cut out of the case book. For example, in the slaughterhouse cases, in which the certain principles of anti-monopoly principles that are supposed to be constitutionalized in the mind of Stephen Field, the son of a Protestant minister, are rooted in the Declaration of Independence and also in the Bible. And that phenomenon in which judges arrogate the right to speak morally and to speak before a religious tradition in which power has become diffused is one that's not unique to the Muslim world. It's so far back in the past and sort of, you know, is evident in parts of the casebooks that have been cut out that we don't realize that it can happen anywhere and that it has happened in the modern Middle East.
Thank you very much. Well, clearly we've given people an opportunity to collect their thoughts because we now have a long queue. And I think the head of that queue is Nathan.
Thank you. We've just heard two papers that seem to be very much at loggerheads, but I think what I wanted to do was just to take a moment to amplify something, Clark, that you said towards the end of actual, I think, an area of overlap between your paper and Karima's paper. You know, the contrast is obviously very clear. And a lot of the discussion, a lot of the comments that you got, Karima, on your paper were sort of along the lines of kind of political strategizing. Does it make sense to fight the battle on that turf? Can't you fight it on the turf of Islamic law and so on? And your response is, you know, if you really got to fight for the principle of secularism, but it was really sort of a political strategizing. My own question is, I don't know the North African context very well, but it seems to me that secularism isn't necessarily going to get you what you want. It's not just that it has less purchase in or resonance in political debates. We go back to something that's, I think, implicit in something Clark said, and something that I talked about with him last night as well. If you look at the Egyptian law of personal status, it is, in one sense, a secular law. It's passed by a parliament. It predates the 1971 Constitution as provision for Islamic law. It is the law of default. That is to say, if you're an Egyptian of one religious group and you're involved in a marital dispute or, you know, divorce case or something like that with one from a different religious group, this is the law, this is the default law that they go back to. It is a secular law. It is drawn from parliamentarians' understandings of Islamic jurisprudence, but you know, in form, it's a secular law. So the contrast between a secular and religious law isn't necessarily clear in practice. The grandson you were talking about was Ibrahim al-Hudaybi, is that right? I met him when he was still in the Muslim Brotherhood, and he said something to me that just sounded very strange, maybe one of the reasons he left the Brotherhood. When I was asking him about the Brotherhood's position on different matters of Islamic law, and he said, you know, the problem for us as the Brotherhood is we're just an opposition movement, and we're going to have to start thinking about those interpretations of Islamic law that we think the state should enforce and those that we just think are binding on us as, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood happens to interpret Islamic law this way, but, distinguish between those two kinds of categories. And I listened to this, I said, this is a secularizing argument. You're privatizing understandings of Islam, except in a few specific areas. So that the borderline, I mean, secularism and is not necessarily going to get you what you want. The line between what is secular and what is religious can get very, very muddy. I mean, I think that's one thing that comes out of Clark's paper. However, and this is where I want to amplify on the areas of agreement. Karima, you also talked about the necessity to look at implementing bodies, to not just get tied up in dry formalism. And I think that's a lot of what Clark's saying. It's kind of the who is extremely important here. And I'd also say that this is my own contribution. What really often matters is, especially when it comes to personal status, is the text of the law itself. Constitutional provisions on these issues tend to be fairly vague. And whatever constitutional language is written is going to admit of a wide variety of personal status, actual personal status laws. So again, kind of using Clark's image of understanding this as a very, very political process, my own sense is it makes sense to focus on the political process. And again, I'll conclude, I promise, on this note. The relevant question, to bring back to something that I said this morning, if you look at, to me, what is the really critical debate in the countries that are now writing constitutions, has to do really with the role of the parliament. And that's where the Islamists are really pressing, essentially, to have a strong parliamentary system in Tunisia. In Egypt, they're willing to put up with a mixed presidential parliamentary system because they think that that's something that the military will bear. But hoping eventually to move into a fuller parliamentary system. So the battle is probably better fought much more on the mechanical constitutional provisions on kind of relations among political authorities. I think that's probably a battle that's going to be far more consequential than the symbolic battles over precise verbal formulas, especially if those verbal formulas are divorced from any kind of attention to implementing mechanisms.
Good. Thank you very much, Nathan, for that interesting intervention. We'll go to Karima, I think, at this point. And
Her papers fell back to back. I think it makes for a sort of a bracing debate. Just a few comments and thoughts. One has to do with the notion that Bill raised about sort of distinguishing among what other people call Islamists, what I have used the term fundamentalist to describe. I mean, I think as a sort of empirical matter, that makes sense to be very precise about sort of specific ideological differences. Politically, in terms of the ultimate impact, it makes less sense to me. And one of the things that I was hearing from many people on the ground was that, in fact, they're more afraid of the quote-unquote moderate fundamentalists than they are of the Salafis. And I want to be very careful how I say that, because I think the Salafis are immediately physically more dangerous. If you look at, there have been Salafi armed group attacks in Tunisia now. As an Algerian American, when I look at this, it's very worrying. I mean, they're very minor attacks, but nevertheless. So there's a way in which they're more obviously dangerous. But An-Nahda knows how to speak a certain language. It is perceived and labeled as moderate in the West. I always remember, if you'll forgive me for citing my father, what the Algerian anthropologist Mahfoud Benoun told me during the 90s, which is that as awful as the violence was of the fundamentalist armed groups in Algeria, the GIA and others, in fact, it was Hamas, the Algerian Hamas and the MSP, the precursor to the MSP, that were much more dangerous in terms of being able to actually shift the sort of the governing stance and move forward the broader, quote, Islamist agenda. And if you look at what people like Samir Amin, the Egyptian economist, what Rashid Grimm, the Algerian political scientist, have been saying, in fact, you know, they've been saying something very similar recently. Ali Ashamari said something similar to me when I was in Egypt, when I was in Tunisia. As to sort of whether people are optimistic and what they're worried about, I do think, you know, and this is, I suppose, a retort to myself as well, it is possible to be worried about more than one thing at the same time. And I don't think because people are worried about the SCAF, it doesn't mean they aren't also concerned about the rise of fundamentalism. I found, and I don't know what others have found, I found a huge gender gap, that women are much more worried about this now than men are. And I found that across the region. As to how I used the term rubbish, I'd like this to be very clear because lots of people did not get to read the paper, and I apologize for that. I used the term rubbish very specifically to refer to an article that was written by a young American graduate student named Monica Marks at Oxford University that somehow was published on the New York Times op-ed page 2 days after the Tunisian Constituent Assembly elections in October. And it's very hard to get published on the New York Times op-ed page. And she had gone to Tunisia and had interviewed some of the women of Ennahda and had sort of fallen in love with them and decided that the secular feminist women's rights movement in Tunisia that had also been opposing Ben Ali for many, many years, was somehow French-inspired. There's nothing worse that you can say to discredit a political force in Northwest Africa. They were French-inspired. They were basically inauthentic. They didn't understand Tunisian women, and that it's the women of Ennahda who really represent the hope for women in the country. And that's where I could not help myself. I actually used the term rubbish, and I said that this sort of argument becomes a very useful cover for the Western governments who now seem to want to do business with these fundamentalists precisely because they do not talk about the economic issues, the market issues. They really don't have a problem with that. And I do feel that that kind of argument is very dangerous. And I would love to respond to what Nathan said, but I don't want to take too much time. I do want to say that I don't accept the argument that the family codes are secular. Certainly in Algeria, the understanding of the family code is that it comes from, at least in part, the Sharia. In fact, when I went to try to resolve my father's estate, I was told by the notary that you cannot argue with God when I sort of quibbled about something. And that's what secularism gives you. It is not perfect, it is flawed, but you at least have the idea that everyone is on a human playing field, right? And you can use a human construct to question another human construct.
Thank you very much. Well, on that note, we conclude this session. Let's have a 10-minute break before we go into the final session. But in the meantime, let's just thank our paper. Thank you.